Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohlig right here on LA Talk Radio.
Indeed, you
yes.
are.
And yes,
I am
you
not
are.
Paul Strohle.
You are not.
I am
I'm
not.
Just a girl who can't say
Anybody?
Really? Huh? Anybody? What? Come on.
There you go. All right. How are you, Paul Strohle?
I am good. I'm taking a sip of water. So take it, Michael.
All right. Well, you know, we'd like to probably start the program off correctly, right? With our
sponsor
thank yous.
We should. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, visit BreakdownExpress.com.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to Performing Arts Live for lending their support to our live arts calendar.
Very grateful. Very grateful. Always.
And you know, Paul, of course, we have two guests today.
Two guests in one. No, two guests in
no
two.
One. Yes. Do you think people recall what that is?
Are you old enough to remember Double Mint Gum?
Of course.
Okay. Double Mint Twin.
Sure.
Yes, not to be mistaken.
Our other guest, Carrie Krim, is not old enough to remember.
She's a young lassie. Okay.
She's a youngster.
Two guests today, yes, I said. One in studio and one joining us via the electric telephone. Boy, oh boy, are we dating ourselves? In studio with us, he was born in New Orleans and acted in his first film, Schizopolis.
Schizopolis.
Yeah. All right, there you go, Schizopolis.
It's not a real word, so you're forgiven.
Opposite Steven Soderbergh. Then he acted in Ocean's 11, 12, 13, The Sundance Favorite, Waitress, The Punisher, Bruce Almighty, Bob Funk, Nancy Drew, and as a regular on HBO's Hung.
I'm going to forgo the obvious joke there.
I was just getting excited there. Okay. He stars in the recently selected Coffee Kill Boss.
Yeah,
sounds like a sausage, doesn't it? Premiering at the Austin.
Well, it also thematically with Hung.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
There you go.
Nice timing, Paul. But today we are here with him talking about King of Herrings, his first directing effort and a homecoming of sorts. Chatting with us later in the hour, we are delighted to welcome Eddie Jameson.
Mr. Jemison. Yes, sorry. That's okay.
All my life, people have called me the wrong name.
Really?
It's Jemison. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. It's okay.
Eddie Jemison.
I'm a gem.
Eddie Jemison. It's sort of a gangster name.
It's,
you know?
It is. Irish
Eddie.
Gangster.
Yeah, it is. Eddie. Yeah. Eddie Jem. Eddie Jem's here. I'm Nicky the Nose. Nicky the Nose. Meet Eddie the Jem.
It's good to meet you, Nicky.
Thank you. It's a beautiful thing. Did you take care of that thing for me?
I got the thing done.
Where we went that time with the guy who celebrates Hanukkah? Remember?
That guy. He's not going to be trouble anymore.
He's not going to be a problem anymore. Okay.
I got the cannoli.
Well, not in the biblical sense. Before we get to Eddie, we'll be chatting with a brilliant playwright whose first full-length play, Growing Pretty, premiered at the Michael Weller Theater in New York and subsequently at the Purple Rose Theater, which was founded by Jeff Daniels, where she is a resident artist. Her second play, Wake, premiered at the Purple Rose in 2009 and was recently produced by a very good company here in town, Seaglass Theater. Personally attached to, in Los Angeles. She has had readings and developmental workshops at the Pasadena Playhouse, Primary Stages, Luna Stage, a solo repertory theater, Manhattan Class Company, and the Next Theater Company in Chicago. Her 10-minute play, Green Dot Day, was a finalist for the 2011 Heidemann Award and won Miami City Theater's inaugural National Short Play Competition. Joining us in just a few moments during a brief break in rehearsal from the world premiere of Conviction, opening this weekend at the Rubicon Theater, Carrie Krim will join us shortly. I'm really excited about talking to Carrie.
Oh, she's such a lovely lady.
She is.
She's talented.
And a great person. And
yes,
a very, very nice person. Indeed. But before we get to Carrie, how was your week, Michael? What happened?
Super busy.
Yeah?
What's going on? Very busy. You know, I've just an acquaintance of mine who we've talked about on this program before, who's actually been on this program before, John Lloyd Young.
Oh, yes. John Lloyd Young.
The Tony Award winner. Jersey Boys, yeah?
Yeah.
And, Frankie Valli, he played,
on
right?
On Broadway, Tony Award winner, and the movie. Oh, yeah. So
and he created the role, right?
Created the role, yeah. Yes. And he is doing two concerts at Sterling's upstairs at the Federal.
Yes.
A supper club that I have and I produce. And we're so excited because we did an unofficial announcement yesterday morning.
Right.
And both concerts went clean within 4 hours.
What you mean? It means sold out.
Yeah, completely.
Is that the term? Went clean?
Yes.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and just one hit on it, and we had over 100 phone calls just on that show alone.
Wow. So you have standing room now, or you have a waiting list?
Well, it's a waiting list at this point. Yeah.
Because I'm going to be there, actually.
Though. Are you?
Yes, yes.
I didn't know.
No,
that.
I park cars at the Federal.
Oh, yeah. You do?
Yeah.
What don't
I was,
you do?
I was going to perform there, but I had a conflict.
What would that have been?
I can't sing or dance.
Oh.
Oh, look at the time. Oh, it's a tough room.
Yeah. There's nobody in it.
Yes.
That's why.
What's that great Dangerfield line? I stopped being in show business for a while. I quit. And to give you an idea how well I was doing when I quit, I was the only one who knew I quit.
Yeah.
Love that one.
And you, sir,
yes.
As I walk in the studio, you've been busy. You've got your beautiful film, The Beating.
Yeah.
All these film festivals.
Cannot, just now we can say it all because they're all out there. So we got Sedona, San Jose, International Short Film Festival, San Diego Film Festival. We're in the film market at Palm Springs. We're going to be in the Bel Air Film Festival. And, of course, another appearance at the Collegetown Film Festival, which takes us to Ohio University after already being at Penn State and Columbia. Could not be happier, and I'm so grateful to everyone involved, not only all the people that were part of the team, but most specifically Cyrus Miracore, who is the director to watch.
His nice
work
man.
Is phenomenal, and we're hoping to put together a feature for next year with Eddie sort of being our example and our
spiritual leader.
Our
Eddie
leader.
Jemison?
Yeah, Eddie Jemison, yeah.
Palm Springs is huge. What? That's great.
Yeah, no, we're really excited about San Diego as well, because San Diego is a great festival.
My hometown.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I know. I'll be thinking of you when I'm there.
Thank you.
And when I'm on Chantilly Avenue, is that the street?
Chantilly, which my father affectedly called Chantilly.
Chantilly.
Yes.
Ah, so he was a smoking jacket, spats-wearing type too, huh?
I don't know. I never knew him very well. It was what?
Enough about us. Let's get to Miss Krim, who's waiting patiently on the phone. Michael, would you give her
I will.
Introduction?
Gladly so. Charismatic, confident, and caring, Tom Hodges is that guy. The teacher's students adore and parents admire. The smart, wisecracking colleague with all the answers. The neighbor who takes care of the neighborhood. The seemingly perfect husband and father. But when a student accuses Tom of crossing a line, his friends and family can't help but question his actions and relationships become splintered. This delicately balanced, beautifully nuanced new drama digs deep beneath the surface of a happy suburban existence to explore the damage done when seeds of mistrust are planted. The play is Conviction, a world premiere opening this weekend at the beautiful acclaimed Rubicon Theater in Ventura, California. Please welcome playwright Carrie Krim.
Carrie!
Hello, thank you.
Hello, Carrie.
You know, Carrie, one of these days we have to get you in studio. We had you on the phone last time you were here, and we just need you to be involved in things that are closer, or we're going to end up paying for your babysitter just to have you in.
Yeah.
Will that work out for you?
You know what? I'll take either one, or we can put her on as well. She's becoming quite the chatterbox.
Oh, is she? Okay. All right. Well, thank you for stepping out of rehearsal for us. We're looking forward to chatting with you about this. Carrie, I always like to ask our playwrights, and it may seem like a trite question or something you've heard before, but was there a particular causal event that sort of inspired you for this, or was it sort of a collective effect of things in the news and whatnot?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
There was a causal event, and then it became collective after that.
Okay.
The first thing was that I was volunteering at a summer camp for kids who had lost a parent or a sibling. And at the orientation for the summer camp, one of the things that really stuck out for me was that they told us, you know, never hug a camper unless you hug multiple campers at once. Never take a camper to the restroom unless you take another adult with you. Never be behind a closed door with a camper. Certainly never allow them, you know, to climb into your bunk in the cabin. And that this is for your own protection as much as for theirs, because if it comes down to a he said, she said, or a he said, or, you know, that there wasn't much that they could do. And, of course, I understand why these rules are in place, but it got me thinking back to my own summer camp days when we would all climb into the counselor's bunk and read ghost stories by flashlight and eat bad food. And I think that we've become a more hypervigilant society sort of across the board. And there are certainly incidents that have led us here, but it really got me thinking about the journey from one place to the next. And then while I was doing that, it just seemed like every time I opened the newspaper or looked online, there was another story about something happening with a teacher and a student, whether it was male teacher, female teacher, male student, male, female, female. There just seemed to be a lot in the news. And it might have just been because I was now sort of attuned to it.
It's unfortunate that we have to think that way, but it is. I mean, the point that you made, it's not only, you know, for obviously the protection of the child, but the protection for the adult. What was that? The great seminal play about the bad seed,
yeah,
where they spread the rumors about the two teachers being lesbians. Is that the
The Children's Hour.
Children's Hour. I'm sorry. Bad Seed was about the bad child, but Children's Hour was about that. I'm sorry.
Lillian Hellman.
Yes, I'm just trying to thanks keep for you signing, honest. Eddie. Thank you. Hold up the flashcards for me, Eddie. Thank you so much. Make me sound look like the literate genius that
finish
I am.
Finish your point.
Although I think Bad Seed could have almost worked for that title too. But
Bad Seed could have worked for that. But now,
Now that you know we're talking about this, I actually just flash back to something in my childhood with this, which I had actually forgotten until you brought this up. But
what's up?
Nothing personal.
Oh, to share.
But bit too much to share.
Oh, okay.
Well,
no.
But what's interesting is the number of people who have said that very thing to me when we start talking about this play. Everybody seems to have a story or knows someone that has a story. So it's actually a lot more common than I think we even realize. I mean, there's, of course, the sort of salacious headlines, but then there's also just the more kind of everyday stories that you hear about.
Yeah, right. Now, Carrie, this is a sort of a collective world premiere, isn't it? Because this was done at the this is almost the same. How would you phrase it? Because I know it was at the Bay Street Theater.
It was. It is a co-production. So it was co-produced by the Rubicon Theater, Bay Street Theater, Dead Posh Productions, and the Royal Manitoba Theater Center in Canada. So it's a four company co-production, and we just opened in Sag Harbor a few months ago with a different cast, but sharing the set and the director and the designers.
Oh, okay.
So we have a brand new cast here, except for one person. The young man playing the son is the same, but the rest of the cast is completely different, but yet it's the same production. So it's been a really interesting process and really fun for me to get to see sort of, you know, the same play, but different. Of course, every actor brings their own stuff to it, so it's still a different interpretation, and that's been really interesting.
Now, I've attended a show at the Rubicon. I attended their wonderful production of Sunset Limited that they did last year with an old friend of mine and a great friend of the show here, Tucker Smallwood, who is in that production. And I've actually performed at the Bay Street in Sag Harbor with a one-man show that I toured with. And I those rooms are distinctly different. So how is that dynamic of the two? I mean, you said that the set is brought over, but if I remember correctly, the style of the theater and the setup of the theater is different. Do you find that is sort of affecting the theater goers' experience? Well, it hasn't opened yet, but how do you see that affecting the theater goers' experience?
You know, that will be really interesting to see, and it's also a testament to everybody working on the production just that they were able to adapt that set and make it work here, because it is the same, and yet it is different.
Right.
The levels, you know, there were different levels there that they don't have here. But it's been really fascinating to sort of see how they made it work. And because I look at it and I say, oh, yep, that's the Hodges living room. It looks just like their living room, and yet it's designed for such a different space. So,
you know, it's really astounding about that dynamic, especially for people who aren't performers. How different the relationship with the audience is depending on where you are. Like at the Bay Street, the audience sort of voms away from you. You're at the lowest point,
and they're looking down at you.
And I, when I toured with the show that I did, it was a completely different. People weren't intimidated by me at all if they were sitting higher, you know. But if I was above them, there would be a real. I would sort of have to. Almost win their confidence before they warmed up. You
I
know?
Bet you they were intimidated by you.
Well, most people are, but it's mostly because I hate wearing pants on stage. Always have. And I don't like to talk about it on the radio, but thanks for bringing it up, Eddie.
Talk about bringing up something in your
anyway. So, Carrie, so now let me ask you something. What other thing? Anything else in the hopper for you while, I mean, I know you've got a lot on your dance card, but any other things going on for you? You working on any new plays or tweaking any old ones? What do you got?
I am. I just had a short play open in Fort Lauderdale. Actually, it's just about to close. It's been running for about a month. It's called the Shorts Gone Wild Festival, and it's about to close, so that was a lot of fun. And then I'm working on a brand new play that is sort of in that stage of... I can't talk about it yet because I'm afraid that I will mess it up. But it's another drama, not like Conviction, but it's a drama, not a comedy. And then I am working on adapting a play that I wrote a while back into a screenplay.
Yes, yes. No, we talked about that before. That sounds very exciting.
Now,
we'll talk about that.
I have a question to ask you, closer. Carrie and Paul, since you both are more acquainted with the Rubicon. I know the Rubicon, of course, for its wonderful productions that they do, but I've never been there.
Oh, you know
what? Is it a little inland, or is it right there?
You know, it's
coast?
In Ventura, but the thing is that everyone thinks that it's like four buses, a rickshaw, and a jetpack to get there, and it's not.
Yeah.
You know, you get on. It's especially easy for me because I'm starting in Tarzana. You just get on the 101 and you keep driving. And I was there last time I went there. I was there in 35 minutes.
Really?
I think it took me to get there. And it's a beautiful space. And the other great thing about it is the little town of Ventura right there. It's a 5-minute, 8-minute, 10-minute walk. All of these little restaurants and shops. Mm-hmm. I had a great Italian restaurant whose name escapes me right now. But it's one of those things. Get there early, do dinner, and then go. It's a nicer little theater you're not going to find. And much like going to Pasadena or going outside of L.A. proper, you can exhale. There's space. Yeah. There's parking.
There's a great walk along the water.
Right.
You can get right to the beach very easily, too. So I really love this town.
No, it was really lovely. The people were very nice there when went to see the show. They were
Carrie, that means you've had two plum jobs this year out here in Los Angeles, right? You had
wait. I have. I'm thinking it might just be time to move out here. then I could come into the studio.
Yeah,
exactly.
Let's throw the information out there. We'll certainly throw this out again before the end of the hour. This is Conviction at the Rubicon in Ventura. Previews Wednesday, September 3rd, so yesterday, and previews again tonight and tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And then it opens Saturday at looks like there's a 7. Is it a 7 p.m. start time for Saturday? Is that correct?
It is. It's a 7 p.m. start time. They're doing a big black tie gala. So there's a red carpet and the show and then a gala afterwards.
Red carpet arrival. Yes.
Fun night.
And then it runs through Sunday, September 28th. I am actually going, Michael, on Sunday to see this.
Yes, I know.
Looking forward to that. I'll be attending the Sunday. There's the matinees are 2 o'clock. And I'm trying to find it here. Oh, here it is. Here we go. And for tickets, you want to, I'm looking for the, oh, there
yeah,
we
it's
go.
It's just
805-667-2900.
That's couldn't be more simple.
805-667-2900. And I'm furiously looking for, it's RubiconTheater.org. And theater has the R-E spelling, RubiconTheater.org. And like I said, we'll say that again before the end of the hour.
And tickets start at $25. So,
that's a thing, great stuff out here. And it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg like it does in New York.
Fantastic.
What Michael was alluding to, for the listeners who don't know, is that my theater company, Seaglass Theater, produced Carrie Krim's Wake earlier this year. At the in Pasadena at the Fremont Center Theater, and it remains, and Carrie, I don't even know if we told you this, but it now stands in our 5-year history as our most successful production, both critically and monetarily. So we were very, very pleased and couldn't be happier. And another thing too about Carrie, and I'm gonna flatter you a little, Carrie, and you're not here, so I don't have to watch.
Are you standing up?
Watch
you
blush.
Down?
But Carrie came in at the end of our rehearsal process, and so much of the time. When a playwright steps in, you're just like, oh, what's going to happen now? You know, because there are these people that, you know, their words are engraved in tablets somewhere. And if you change a comma, you know, you get a tantrum. And Carrie's weighed in and made incredible suggestions for us and suggestions about her own work. And it was so collaborative. And the play was so much better because of her her presence. And we're very, very grateful to you for that, Carrie. We really are. And thank you so much for...
Well, thank you. And you guys made that very easy. So,
it's collaboration. That's what it's about.
That's right. Yeah. It was a lovely show, wonderful show. People had a great time. And as Sea Glass is known for the way they put on a production, you know, starting from the whole experience from the moment you arrive at the theater before you even get into the theater.
Yeah, well, you know, with holding, in the case of Wake. With an award-winning sweepstakes check out front, which sort of threw people in the world of the play. Carrie, Wake had a good number of comedic elements, even though the themes were not necessarily comedic. Does Conviction have any of that, or would you just call it a sort of a straight drama?
It does. You know, my way of dealing with hardship typically is through humor. So Conviction has a lot more dark humor than Wake did. I mean, Wake's humor was dark, too, since it was dealing with a funeral home. But Conviction, I would call Wake more of a dramedy.
Right.
And Conviction is very much a drama that has elements of humor. And I hope that those elements come just at the moments when you sort of need just a breath to then be able to get back into it. And it's not humor that is taking away from the drama, but I feel like it's humor that is hopefully the kind of real-life humor that we all tend to use when things are kind of piling up on us.
Right, you know,
sometimes you just, that's the only avenue.
Right. And given the subject matter, Carrie, is there sort of an age that you're the most, as the creator of it, that you're the most comfortable with in terms of attending? Like a break-off
point? Yeah, it's definitely
point?
Not for kids. If you have, you know, mature high school students, I think that's okay.
Okay.
I have friends who have brought their kids, but they're all kind of like theater-savvy kids who have certainly... seen much worse, but I would say teenagers and above.
Okay.
They see worse on television and in film, but there is something about live theater, I feel like, that makes it so immediate that
the
sometimes
immediacy.
It's
right.
Little bit harder, but it has tended to spark some great discussions, and I love it when teenagers weigh in on it because they're going through it right now.
Oh, yeah, that's the best. That's the best when you get that chat.
Carrie, I have a question for you. From the time that you premiered your first full-length play, which was Growing Pretty, I think you did that at the Michael Weller Theater in New York, to now, how do you look upon the past? What do you think about your work, you know, starting with that play and to what you're doing now in California? Do you feel that you have taken a journey of growth and arrived at a place that you are very satisfied with, or is there still things on your bucket list as a playwright that you want to accomplish and are headed in that direction?
You know, I am happy with the journey, and I still feel like the journey has a long way to go. If that sort of answers that. I feel like I have grown so much from the first play until now. And so now, even after having written Conviction, which I do feel like is my strongest of the four, I'm so excited to get to work on the fifth one because I get to bring everything that I learned from this process into the writing of that process. And so each one is sort of its own journey, and you sort of have your own dreams for each play, I guess, like people do for each of their children. But I actually went back and looked at my very first play, Growing Pretty, because I thought, what would that be like to rewrite that play from the writer that I am now?
Right.
Just with how much I've learned about structure and character and all that kind of stuff. But as I read it, I thought, you know, this was just a lovely little play for what it was. And I've kind of moved on. So what I would rather do is, you know, go on and write the next play as opposed to going and trying to redo something that was so specifically a part of the writer that I was then and the person that I was then. But no, the bucket list is still long. I don't even know specifically what it is. I just hope that the journey continues for quite a while.
Well, we wish you the greatest success.
And
with
we'll
it
be
at the
watching.
Rubicon, and absolutely, we're big fans of yours.
Looking forward to Sunday, Carrie, not only to see the play, but to also see you and your lovely family and see those people out at the Rubicon. And once again, we'll throw the information for tickets out there. But we know you have a rehearsal to get back to, Carrie. And thank you so much for making time for us. We always love to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. And it was delightful. And I will see you Sunday.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thanks, Carrie.
All right.
Bye-bye. Such a nice lady.
She's the greatest.
Yes, she is.
She's the greatest.
Very sweet.
And that play sounds interesting to me.
Doesn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah. And she just, you know, one of the great things about Carrie's work is that where I think, and we can even touch on this when we chat with Eddie, because it's such an important thing, dialogue, effective, natural dialogue. And so many people have these great ideas for plays, and they put things together, and their themes are all, you know, well-intentioned, and they have all this stuff, and then they don't write like people speak, and it makes me crazy. One of the things I used to do when I was writing my thing is that I would write, and then I'd write out what I thought the lines should be, and then I'd turn the paper over, and I would paraphrase it extemporane, and then I knew anything important would stick with me, and any of the fat would just fall away, and you just get such a leanness of speech that way, and you're also hipper, which is why you snap your fingers and come like a hipster.
It's also amazing how little you need.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I found out I could cut out lots of huge chunks of exchange between two people because you don't actually need it.
You don't need it, and also you know how much you didn't need it by how little patchwork it takes to fill the hole. You know, if you could go one sentence to the other, you know. But I'm really excited to talk to Eddie, and we want to pay the bills and get our arts calendar out of the way.
Let's do
and
that.
And then before we do that, I will kick it off, Michael, if you
please,
don't mind.
Please.
Dance the Dream Los Angeles brings the city and county together of Los Angeles from Compton to Beverly Hills to demonstrate solidarity for the values and goals of the I Have a Dream speech. In addition to featuring LA's top professional and student dancers, their music tapings include this year's Spotlight finalists, LA Opera soloists from the Young Artist Program, Burroughs High School Choir, the inspiration for the Glee TV series on which they've been featured, Centennial High School Marching Band, and 11-year-old violin prodigy Maya Masaoki, among others. Dance the Dream Los Angeles is presented by Cars Productions and Dance Camera West.
And everyone is invited to join LA's top professional and student dancers in celebrating the values of brotherhood proclaimed by Dr. King. All untrained dance participants will be taught on location very basic moves to be repeated in unison with the assistance of volunteers. Dance the Dream Los Angeles is being taped for the feature documentary The Dream, The Mission of Dance. The dream is to demonstrate the creative dynamism.
I don't know. I've never seen that word before.
Dynamism. What would you say, Eddie?
I think you predict
creative dynamics. Dynamics. Yes.
Dynamism of cultural diversity to build stronger communities based on the model of collaboration in the arts and to inspire and empower the next generation to follow in the footsteps of Martin Luther King Jr. and make the world better. This is a free event that begins in just a few hours at 3:30 p.m. today at the Music Center, Los Angeles Music Center Plaza, 245 North Grand Avenue, Los Angeles, California. So please bring your children, bring yourself, a great project and a great idea.
Yeah, and you know, Michael, more often than not, we like to have more of a lead-in on these things, but when we this came across my desk today, and it sounded so great that just anything we can do to, especially with it being a free event, who knows, people might be downtown with their kids.
That's right, and timely to the season of dance on television, because So You Think You Can Dance just had its finale last night, and they always do such great work in promoting the art of dance and give these kids these amazing careers. Up the ante this year. You win $250,000 just for winning the thing, and you get put into the Broadway show.
And they just announce the cast for the celebrity dance one, the one Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, Tommy Chong actually is on the list from Cheech and Chong.
Oh my!
Yeah, Yeah.
Well, well, well.
Go to watch that one.
That just made me think of something. This real quick. I was at the cleaners yesterday and dropping some shirts off to be laundered, and the wafting of marijuana was in the air, and I thought it was
fun. I'm glad it's about the marijuana, not the chong, because I thought you were going to go, I was having my shirts done, because I thought it was an Asian slam, but yeah, it turns out it was...
Okay. Not at all, not, but I did Cheech and Chong and right, marijuana, right. But... And I thought, oh my God, it's like somebody in the place here is like lighting up or
yeah,
something. And I said,
up.
Do you smell what I smell? And she said, oh yeah. She said, all day long. I said, what? She said, well, see that shop right over there? And it was one of the
what we used to call head shops.
Dispensaries.
Yeah.
Yes, dispensaries. Yeah. And it was, I don't know what they were doing. You know, had a group smoke in there or something? I have no idea. But I said, I have to leave. I'm getting high.
Yeah.
Just dropping my shirt.
Yes, yes. Do me a favor, starch the collars and bring chocolate chip cookies
exactly.
next time.
Exactly.
All right. In this Stranger Than Paradise meets Swingers world, a group of small-time wannabes spends their days hanging out at coffee shops, playing poker, and talking about women. Things get complicated, though, when one of their group, Ditch, loses his temper and sets a chain of events in motion that leads down a darkly comic road, testing the boundaries of their friendship along the way. This strange tug of war culminates in an unforgettable encounter with a mysterious woman looking for a way out. We are joined by author, actor, and co-director of King of Herrings, which is slated for release in about a month, you said, Eddie?
Sometime in the fall.
Sometime in the fall. By Devolver Digital, and please welcome the talent trifecta that is Mr. Eddie Jemison.
Eddie!
The dynamism!
Huh? The dynamism, yes.
You shouldn't your pronunciation is not in question with that voice that you have.
I know.
You can sell anything.
I know.
Oh, you know, well, thank you.
That's everyone says that. No one compliments my voice when I'm talking with you. And like, what did she, well, the, who did the woman on Facebook, what did she call your voice? Sweet molasses.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
How did you see that?
What?
How did you see that?
I monitor all your internet activity, Michael.
Yeah. Oh, you're one of the people following me,
yes,
are you?
I am. Oh. Well, I guess following is a place. Standing in the bushes out in front of your house is technically following. Eddie, King of Herrings.
Yeah.
First, I saw the trailer. I haven't seen
Thank
the film
you.
Yet.
That's okay.
But I did read about the film, and I'm most curious about, first off, the title. What is
the title is, it's a misnomer. It's the worst title ever.
What?
King of Herrings. Oh, if you say it, it'll sound convincing to me. Would you say King of Herrings?
King of Herrings.
There you go. That sounds right. Yeah. It was based on a monologue inside the film. Mm-hmm. And that monologue was cut, so it's a little bit of a problem.
Oh, okay.
And yet, it's about these guys who are struggling to be the kings of a very small world.
Right.
So I guess it applies in that way.
In their pond.
King of Minnows would be
king
better.
Of, king of Michael, how does that come across? Can you give us that one?
King of Minnows.
Oh, no. Sorry. That doesn't work as well.
Oh, that's so mean.
King of Herrings. Now, you're born in New Orleans.
I'm born there, yeah.
And New Orleans
loves that city.
Yeah, it's a great city.
It's the best. It is filmed there. And set there.
Yeah.
And even from watching just the trailer, it's very much a character in the fiber of who these guys are.
Yeah.
Because they all grew up there. Most of the characters are written as to have grown up there.
Yeah, well, the movie takes place in a very small kind of gritty orbit world, you know, where these guys kind of hang out in diners, just one diner, and along a very small section of the city that is poor and
what section
and
of
fantastic.
Town is it? Where
it's
is it?
It's technically called Mid City,
okay,
but it's not quite downtown, not quite uptown,
okay. Sort of nebulous, sort
it's
of.
It's about. Like, I'll tell you what. It's about a half a mile from the Dome, Superdome.
Okay,
along
All right.
Tulane Avenue.
All right. I was just there for the first time a couple of years ago, and I fell in love. It's the only city with a soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, the music and everything just pulses at you from every. I'm talking about
and
the quarter, but
hanging out at Bourbon Street. There's nothing like that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The city is unique, and that's another reason why I wanted it in the film, because. I wanted to show a part of New Orleans that people don't actually see.
Right, right.
Like, you don't see the Superdome. You don't see the French Quarter. You see the other parts of it.
Right.
It's kind of like, you know how Baltimore, and you ever see The Wire?
Yeah,
the city of Baltimore really plays a character in the
or
piece,
or in any of what's the director of Diner and
Barry Levinson. Levinson. Yeah,
all of his films, Baltimore set, have that sort of undercurrent of not the undercurrent, but you know, it's a character. It's a character in the film.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and can you do? I mean, we sort of led into it. Can you give a little synopsis? Would you prefer not to?
I could do my best. It's about these four friends, these four guys that are this close to being homeless. They don't have jobs. They're not great people. They go to the track, and they have a tug of war, a fight between them over the affections and the over power of this beautiful woman who has sort of agoraphobic. She won't leave her apartment.
Okay.
And so they fight over her.
Right.
And in the process, almost destroy her. But you'll see what happens.
Yeah. No, that's a...
So it's a drama.
It is a drama.
And, you know, and just like Carrie.
But it's interesting. It's interesting. We talked about this beforehand because Michael mentioned my short film. We talked about it where I perform a character in it that is distinctly different from what people expect me to do. And the same thing is happening. One of the articles that I read about this and about you playing against type, people that have seen you in your films, in all the Ocean 11 film, Veronica Mars, things like that, you are a particular type, you know.
Sure.
You play a particular type, usually.
I get cast as nice guys.
Nice guys,
often.
Yes. Because, you know.
Or murderers that you... The reason why they cast me as the murderer because they,
right.
they want to spring it on people later that, oh, he's the killer.
You just, nice guys, murderers, you know, always the same thing. But you play...
Nice murderers.
Nice, only the nicest murderers. You need a nice murderer, you call Eddie the Gem. Eddie the Gem.
He's going to kill you softly.
Will kill you softly with his songs, if you know what I'm saying.
In the nicest possible
somebody,
way.
I assume the character you play in The Beating, mm-hmm. it's this guy is no good from... He's annoying and he's just a jerk throughout.
Yeah,
People don't like me.
No, and you play...
Certainly
in
very edgy.
Edgy, yes, exactly.
Yeah, he's edgy. He's got a temper. He's got a Napoleon complex, and he starts fights... Wherever he goes.
Right. Now, you're just a bastard in this.
Mean bastard.
Yeah, and I'm just
And I had a chip on my shoulder growing up in New Orleans as a little kid. I got into a lot of fights and stuff.
Oh,
because,
did you?
Because being small, I felt like I had to. It wasn't till later when I was told by my disciplinarian at my school.
Is that what they're calling it now?
Why do you feel you have to do this? And I questioned it and... Right. And then I became a nice person.
So you were you were a scrapper when you were younger.
I was.
Okay, but they're protecting you.
So that's what this character comes out of.
Okay.
If I'd never changed.
Right.
Yeah, I'd be this guy. Ditch.
If you never change, you'd still be Ditch. Now, these other guys that he's at the diners with and all that, are they based on people that you grew up with or...
Yeah.
You know, an amalgam of that, or are you not legally permitted to discuss it? Or?
No. You know, when we lived in Chicago, I lived in Andersonville, this neighborhood, mm-hmm. and there were these guys that hung out on the street, on Clark Street, the main street. And me and my friends saw them every day. And they had homes, they weren't homeless, but they didn't live at home. One guy, we called him Wig Man, he had a full head of hair, but he wore a wig on top of it. Another guy we called the cowboy, he had like a scarecrow, you know, with a cowboy hat. And these guys are always fighting. And we would see, there's Wigman, he's at it again with cowboy.
Yeah.
And then we'd see them next day, they'd be all lovey-dovey and drunk.
Right.
So I got to thinking, like, what would these guys, if you really could hang out with them for 24 hours, what would really happen?
Sorry. Right.
Plus, I like stories that are about nothing and everything at the same time, where the stakes are small. But it's everything to these people.
But in
so
that,
the drama's big.
Gotcha.
That's what I was going for.
In that world. Yeah, exactly. You know, another thing we talked about, which leads right into that, looking at the film, which just from the trailer looks stunning.
Thank you.
It's shot in black and white. Mm. As it looks like a Jarmusch, Stranger Than Paradise, we already mentioned. I mentioned to you Down by Law, one of my favorite movies ever. And... but this has a sort of that look. But there's a great quote by Tom Waits where Tom Waits said, "I love I love beautiful melodies telling me terrible things. And I couldn't help but think about that, seeing the beauty of this film and what the subject matter is. But in talking about it beforehand, you said actually, in effect, the opposite is true.
Well, only in that the world that we see is so not beautiful. But I gave it some more thought since we talked. And it is true that it is beautiful. The photography is done by my co-director. His name is Sean Richardson. And it's beautiful. But what we see, the world we see, is petty and grotesque a little bit.
Right.
Much like Tom Waits' characters that populate his songs,
right. That's
exactly the kind of guys these are.
Right, the disagreeable. And that's what makes, I think, the songs so interesting, because he does it, Loudon Wainwright does it, Randy Newman does it. They create a character, a very disagreeable character, and then they sing from the point of view of that character. So it became much more like a theatrical presentation than just a singer imparting a song, more like playing a role and playing a character.
Yeah, like you see the monster, like Caliban, but he's got a part of gold, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, I'm very, very excited to see this.
So, but I have to ask you, how is it, you're wearing so many hats now in this with this project, how is this transition being a director?
It was really hard. I won't lie. The easy part was shooting it and directing it, because all the actors are all character actors.
Right.
We're all pals from, we all went to LSU together, and we all were in Steven Soderbergh's early films. We knew him then. So all these guys know what they're doing, and they all took their characters and ran with it. And I said very little to them. I didn't have to. And whatever I said, they didn't listen to anyway. So that part was a cinch. Yeah. And the cinematography is Sean. He did a beautiful job. But since then, getting this into festivals like you've done, and getting it finally to Devolver, who picked it up, has ruined my life. It's been the worst year.
Really?
A lot of work.
Oh, it's so horrible. All the rejection. I mean, I get enough rejection in auditioning for parts, and then to come home and find another rejection letter from Palm Springs, which I'm very jealous of, that you're in.
Oh, well.
That's hard. And it's a lot, more than anything, it's a lot of work.
Yes, it is.
A lot of emailing.
We had a director. Well, I'm sorry, his name eludes me right now. Dances with Wolves.
Jim. Forget his name. But he did that film, 50 to 1.
Yes. Yes. Very great director.
Yes. First name is Jim, and he's Kevin Costner's producing partner.
That's
he did
right.
a bunch of movies.
That's right.
Forgive us
if you're listening, Jim. Forgive us for not remembering your last name. But
I have him here.
How's it going?
That's another awkward moment.
Yes. I got my name.
No, but he had a similar story with a film that was 50 to 1, and he couldn't get the studios to get behind it.
And this is the guy.
So he did everything.
Yeah.
He released it. He called theaters all across the country, got him in. Same deal that the studios would have gotten for him.
And this is the guy who won an Oscar for Dances with Wolves, and he can't get it out there. Yeah. So don't feel so bad about that, because, at the end of the day, you got it out there.
I did.
That's the most important
thing.
We've lightened your day
and
a little bit.
Here are a couple of reasons. I want to share a couple of these quotes because they're really astonishing. This is from Champ Clark, a staff writer for People magazine. King of Herrings is masterful, a funny, unique slice of life that moves the soul with acting to kill and brilliant writing. It's the best movie I've seen in a long, long time. Another one here from James Grissom, the author of Follies of God. King of Herrings is a perfect jazz riff of a film, funny, urgent, frantic, mournful, something Arthur Penn and John Cassavetes both would find a promising gem. That's just and there's a Mammoth comparison too, and some other things too, which you're in great company there, man. You really are.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks.
The website for all of this is just as complicated as you would imagine. kingofherrings.com. It's just that easy. kingofherrings.com and facebook.com/kingofherrings, and with that you can get to all of the things, the trailer and the IMDb page and all that. And, of course, the announcements about the upcoming release on Devolver Films will be there as well. So watch, what is it, watch this space? Is that what they say? Watch this space?
You know, I'm sorry. I didn't really hear what you said before.
You're not that. Paying any attention.
I was looking at that typo in the release.
Right? You know, Michael, I don't.
I did that release.
So
are there
sorry.
A lot of typos?
Oh, no,
it's not a lot of typos.
You didn't call it IMDb. You call it IMB.
It's a great release, Eddie, but if you could make it available in the unabridged edition that's not the leather-bound volume. Jeez, you owe me an ink cartridge. You owe me an ink cartridge.
Thanks for providing the script for
us. Yes, thank you.
I didn't mean to give you that much information.
No, it's not that. It's the hologram and the pop-up book that really throws me.
I don't know how to do this.
Maybe on your next film, you'll write in a little... maybe cameo for Paul and myself. You know?
I would love to.
Yeah. Here's the other thing, too, though, Eddie. I just thought about this. Maybe there's festivals and things that haven't accepted you yet because they haven't been able to finish the press release yet. So as soon as we hear back from
So Sundance is going to
Sundance
through this.
Yeah.
They've had a year.
Very
exciting.
We're just though. About that time to ask Eddie to share a tale from his performance days. We always like to ask our guests to share something that went wrong during performance. And when I asked you about it before the show, your eyes lit up as though you had one in your quiver.
A doozy, I'm sure.
There's a place called Southern Rep, which is in New Orleans.
Yep.
And they did a production of the Algernon. Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, okay, yeah. I was going to say Flowers for Algernon, but
no.
Importance of Being Earnest.
Yeah, yes, you know, the Oscar Wilde play.
Handbag.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. And they reset it in New Orleans, and it was shown in the Quadroom Ballroom, where the stage was a series of raised platforms, almost like runways.
Right.
Terrible idea. I was Algernon. They cast the butler was an older black gentleman, a cool guy. But when they cast him, they didn't know. And it really wouldn't have mattered. But he had lost a leg.
Mm.
He had a fake leg that he lost diabetes. He and I were great friends. I loved this guy. We walked around the city. He grew up there. And he told me all about, when I was, you know, your age, this is what the city looked like. And it meant a lot to me. So we're, I don't think it was opening night, the second night. We're doing the show. And he came out in his butler outfit with a huge service, silver service for tea, you know, tea serve. He steps immediately 2 inches off this raised platform. The tea service goes everywhere. He grabs for support the curtain, rips it down, revealing Act 2 set. I look down and he's wedged between two platforms down below me about 4 feet, and his leg is at his ear.
Oh my God.
And I thought, my first thought was, oh my God, I have broken this man's only good leg. And you know how, you know, they say that...
The good leg was by his ear?
I didn't know what leg it was. It was just a leg at his goddamn ear. And I lift him up. You know how mothers lift cars off of their children? With the superpower, I lift him up. And he's like a doll. He just fits right back into place. And his leg goes, or it snaps right back into place. And I thought, oh, that's his fake leg, so we're good. And I stand him up, and he looks at me. And I must have looked at him like... what the hell do I do now? And he said, go on with your play. And walked upset and left me there to continue.
Now, how bad was he injured?
He was fine.
He was fine.
Fine.
And he fell between two platforms. His leg went up.
Took a curtain down.
Now, did you find out after the fact? Was it the good leg or the bad
leg? It was the good leg, and I knew immediately. As soon as I pressed him down, he was so confident and so, like I said, so nonchalant, go on with your play, that I knew immediately he was fine.
Yeah. See, my grandfather had an artificial leg and a real foot, which I thought was hot. No, he did. He had an artificial leg. My grandfather lost his leg to diabetic neuropathy, same thing, poor circulation and all that. And he was yelled at once by a woman when he parked in a handicapped parking space. because his placard wasn't visible and he did not look, you know, disabled. Sure. And so he took his leg off and he like, they couldn't chase her with it, but he did wave it at her in an angry
Don't
fashion.
Don't you ever.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandfather lost his leg too, believe really? It or not, in a train accident. He worked for the railroad. And he would, I would see him with his train buddies negotiate. He met, I'm sorry, this is a story. Right. We were mowing a lawn,
yeah.
And I saw him talking to this other guy who hobbled over with a wooden, no leg too. Yeah. And we saw him talking, and we saw my grandfather take off his shoe. We're like, what the hell is he talking about? And we said, Grandpa, what's up? He said, oh, he's missing his left leg. I'm missing my right. We're going to trade shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Pairs of shoes.
Right. Because, yeah, you got one pair. And you get, oh, that's hysterical. Then my grandfather used to talk about the thing he wasn't prepared for was that the laces would get dusty. Because you never had to unlace a shoe from an artificial leg.
If
you
always wanted to say,
so the laces would get dusty. Quick story. Sarah Bernhardt, famous actress.
Yeah, you know, of course.
Lost her leg late in her career. And P.T. Barnum bought the leg, the severed leg, and put it in formaldehyde and toured it so that you could go and you could pay 50 cents and see Sarah Bernhardt's leg. But the state of her career at that point was so bad that her leg was actually generating more money than her performing live. True story.
I'd pay 50 cents.
So would I. Eddie, what a blast to have you
Indeed.
On here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Absolutely. Let's throw the website again, kingofherrings.com. And Michael, would you tell them the conviction info?
Yeah, absolutely. At the Rubicon Theater, ladies and gentlemen, now through September 28th, Kerry Krim's Conviction. Beautiful theater, beautiful town to be
in.
$25 tickets, and that's where they start anyway. And you can simply go to the, or actually call the box office directly at 805-667-2900.
And it's RubiconTheater.org with theater having the R-E spelled.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
What a pleasure. Eddie, a blast having
you
here.
Thank you so much.
And
yes, congratulations. Good luck on everything that's coming up for you. Paul, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. See you next week.
See you on the radio.
Listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strohle, right here on LA Talk Radio.